All of us have experienced suffering at some time or another. To say that same thing another way, we've all lost something that's caused suffering. And sometimes it's minor, and sometimes it can be very severe, like losing a job, or the loss of your health, or perhaps one of the most severe cases of all would be losing a child. Well, we've been looking at Job, and he had all of those experiences. Now, in Job's case, and very often in ours, when we experience especially a serious or severe loss, family and friends come to visit, to comfort and console. Now, what I want to do is talk about that visit. I want to talk about it from the standpoint of the people who come to visit, but in Job chapter 3, he spends most of the time talking about his response to the visitors. In both cases, there are things here we can learn of an intensely practical matter. So let me address the question of what do you do when friends come to comfort you? Interesting question. Turn to Job chapter 3 and let's see what Job says. And as you're doing that, let me remind you that as I've said already as we've begun this series through Job, that Job begins with a prologue, an introduction, a preface. And that goes from chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 10. Then begins the body of the book. And that starts at chapter 2, verse 11, and goes all the way almost to the end of the book. Goes into chapter 42. That body is radically different than the prologue at the beginning and the epilogue at the end. And the stark difference in the Hebrew text is this. The epilogue at the end and the prologue at the beginning are in prose, but everything in between is in poetry. Now, that marks out the fact that there's a significant transition at each of those points, but it also tells us something about the way we should look at the core of this book, that it's written in highly figurative language. A lot of poetic language is used in this book. He's not just reporting facts, he's reporting those facts in poetic fashion. One other observation as we enter the body of the book, and that is this. We're going to look at chapter 3 tonight, and that is a speech by Job. There follows three rounds of speeches by his friends, and then at the end of that, there are two more speeches by Job, soliloquies, if you will. It has been suggested that the speech in chapter 3 and the two speeches by Job in chapter 28, beginning in chapter 28 and going through chapter 31, are sort of bookends that put the bulk of the body of the book in focus. So Job begins the discussion, then there are three rounds from his friends, and he ends the discussion. After that, a fourth friend shows up, and after that, God speaks. So what we're going to do tonight is look at this first speech by Job, but we're going to begin in chapter 2 because that's where the body of the book begins. Now, it's a long passage, so we're going to summarize a lot of what is here, but let's begin with chapter 2, verse 11. We are told, "Now when Job's three friends heard of all the adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place, Elipus, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, Zophar, the Naamanite, for they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him." Note, the purpose of their visit is to mourn and to comfort. Very interesting. Verse 12, And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted up their voices and wept. Each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. I'm going to pause here because this is just about the visit of the friends. When we get into chapter 3, we'll talk about Job's response to them. But first I want to talk about the visit of the friends. When somebody has a severe loss or is in suffering, what do you do? If you're their friend, what do you do? Well, it seems to me these verses give us the ideal of what a friend should do if another friend gets in trouble. Number one, just be there. Matter of fact, these verses tell us that they came from their own place, and the implication seems to be that they traveled some distance to get there. So when they heard, the first thing they did is drop everything and go to Job. Just be there. Now, I'm amazed at how many people don't do that. They don't know to do that. And I know of some stories where the reason they didn't is because they didn't know what to say. I'm going to talk about that in a second. One of the classic illustrations of that I've ever heard of was my wife worked in a high school as an interpreter for the deaf for better than a dozen years. And she had a colleague that had worked there for 10 of those years and knew everybody well. And that lady's mother died, and nobody said a word. Nobody said a word. As a matter of fact, in some cases, they even tried to avoid her. And so sometime later, she said to them, why didn't you come see me? Or why didn't you say something? And they said to her, we didn't know what to say. And I think that happens. So here's the word. Number one, if you have a friend that's having a problem, just be there. Drop everything and go. To have a friend like that is priceless. And that's what happened to Job's three friends. As I pointed out in reading, their purpose in coming was to mourn and to comfort. So that's as good as it gets. That if you go to visit somebody who's suffering, you're not their judge, you're not their jury at this point. You should go mourn with them, and you should attempt to comfort them. Now the text tells us when they got close enough to see Job, and as I've already said, this was a hideous sight. He was covered with boils from head to toe. It says that each one tore his robe, sprinkled dust on his head toward heaven, lifted up his voice and wept. Now this is a typical way they grieved in the ancient world. So the point is, when they saw Job, they entered into the emotion of his experience and they grieved with him. And then the text says, they sat down on the ground for 7 days and seven nights and didn't say a word. Now, is that fascinating or what? In light of the fact that some people don't go because they don't know what to say, this is a particularly insightful statement. Just be there. What you say is not the issue. Your presence is the issue. You may get there and say nothing. I don't know how many times I've gone into situations like this, and I didn't know what to say. As a matter of fact, when I was in seminary, I pastored a church. And needless to say, I was a very young man. And the first time somebody died, I said to an older pastor, what do I do now? He said, you go immediately. And I said, and when I get there, what do I say? He said, maybe nothing, just go. And he was dead right, just go. I often walk in, hug them. That's a good way to start, just hug them. Well, they sat down and they said nothing. Now, commentators go crazy trying to explain their silence. Some of them go so far as to suggest that they were mourning and that the way they mourn was the way you mourn for a dead person. So they're assuming he's going to die or something, or is mourning as if he were about to die. Or they didn't say anything to him, but they were discussing it among themselves. Or they just were respecting him and allowed him the opportunity to speak first. Whatever the explanation, maybe they just reacted out of horror. The latter part of verse 12 says, no one spoke a word to him, for they saw his grief was very great. I think that's the explanation. They saw how great his grief was, and at that moment, words are not the issue. Just be there and listen. Now, that doesn't surface until we get to the next verse in chapter 3, verse 1, but that's what they did. They were silent and Job talked. So, write this down. Remember this. You want to know how to be a good friend and minister to somebody who's in trouble? Be there, be silent, and listen. Comes straight out of the book of Job. Got that? All right. Somebody has said, when they commiserated with him, they didn't sit in a comfortable home or hospital. They sat with him on the ash heap, surrounded by refuge, because their grief was so great, they couldn't speak for 7 days. Now, what I liked about that comment was that they entered into the grief, and that's very clear. Sit there in silence, but understand how this person feels. Key word, feels. This is not the time for a theological lecture. This is the time for understanding how the person feels. Got it? Got it. All right, what happened next? Job starts talking. So now we're going to switch from being the person who has a friend that's suffering to being the friend who is suffering. So let's suppose now you are the one that's suffering. How do you respond to the friends who come to see you? What do you do? Well, for the next 26 verses, Job talks. Now, if I go through all of these verses and we spend any time at all on each one, we'll be out in time for breakfast in the morning. So I'm not going to do that. However, there is a very simple outline to what's going on here. And I do want to read the verses and comment on them as I read them. The first thing Job says is shocking. Chapter 3, verse 1. May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived. Whoa! The first thing Job says is, I wish I were never born. Wow. He said that? And God had him write it down in a book? Yep. I'm going to comment on this later because it gets a whole lot worse. He not only says, I wish I were never born. He says, I wish I was never conceived. Look at it. After this, he opened his mouth and he cursed the day of his birth. And Job spake and said, may the day perish in which I was born and the night in which it was said a male child is conceived. So He wanted to curse the day he was born and curse the night he was conceived. By the way, let me tell you what he didn't do. He didn't curse God, which is what Satan said he would do, which his own wife suggested he do. So that's what he didn't do. But what he did do is he said, I curse my birthday, not God. Now, I want to point out something else. I want you to look at verse 2 carefully. A male child is conceived. If this were being written today, a lot of people would write it, and a fetus came into being. When does life begin? According to this verse, a male begins at conception.
Amen.
How, look at that. How's that for a biblical basis for when life begins? I think that's great. All right, that's a footnote. That was extra. All right, the point is, he wanted to wipe from the calendar the day he was conceived and the day he was born. Now, in verse 4, he says, may the day be darkness, may God above not seek it, nor the light shine upon it. And this is just a poetic way of saying the same thing. He wishes the day of his birth had never seen the light of day. That's the point of verse 4. He would that God did not remember it. He wanted God not to regard it, but it's stated poetically. Look at verse 5. May darkness and the shadow of death claim it. May the clouds settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it. He wished the day of his birth had died, that the clouds settled on it so that it couldn't be seen, and that the blackness scared it to death. So again, he's saying the same thing. I wish I had never been born, only he's saying it in highly figurative, poetic language. Verse 6, and as for the night I was conceived, may the darkness seize it. May it not rejoice among the days of the years, that it may come into the number of months. Now at this point, he's going to turn to the night of his conception. He's been talking about primarily about the day of his birth. And he poetically wishes that that night had never occurred. That's the point of verse 6. He says in verse 7, oh, that the night might be barren. May no joyful shout come from it. In other words, his wish is what his mother had been barren rather than pregnant, and that there'd been no joy because of conception. And then he says this, verse 8, and may those curse it who curse the day, and those who are ready to arouse the Lethean, God wishes that they would arouse the Lethians. All right, the question becomes, who are they? And the point is rather simple. He said, there are people who curse days. Well, may they curse the day I was born. And again, the point is, I wish I were never born. Now, these creatures are sometimes said to be sea monsters, but later in the book they come up, and I think later in the book they are crocodiles. At any rate, he's just saying, I wish some kind of animal would have come in and highly figurative, poetic language, and erase this day. Just curse this day. Just get rid of this day. Verse 9, may the stars in their morning be dark. May they look for light, but have none, and see the dawning of the day. In other words, he wishes that the night of his conception and the stars had not shined, that they would be extinguished. It's just another way of saying, I wish I had never been born, and that day had never happened. One more, verse 10. Because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide the sorrow from my eyes. In other words, he wants the night of his conception and the day of his birth to be a closed door, so that his mother's womb would have prevented all of his sorrows. If his mother's womb had been shut, he wouldn't have seen all this trouble in his life. All right? I wish I'd never been born. You ever heard anybody say that? You ever thought that? Yeah, I think it's more common than we imagine. I've talked to many people who've said something similar. All right, beginning at verse 11, he gives a second thought. Then he says this, verse 11, why did I not die at my birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Now, in verses 1 to 9, he's saying, I wish I had never been born. Beginning in verse 11, I should say, he starts saying, I wish I had died when I was born. I should have said verses 1 to 10. He says, I wish I had never been born. And now he says, all right, if I had to be born, I wish I'd have died when I was born. And he picks that theme up at verse 11. I wish I'd been stillborn. I wish I'd immediately died right after I was born. Even in his tremendous bitterness and grief, he does not suggest that his mother have an abortion, which, by the way, was common in the ancient world. So I'm not reading that into the text. That was an option, and he didn't take that one. All right, verse 12, same theme now. Why did the knees receive me? Or why did the breast that I should nurse? Now, again, this is poetic language. And when a baby was born, they put it on the knees of the grandparents. So he's really saying, if I'd have died, they wouldn't have put me on the knees. If I'd have died, I wouldn't have been breastfed by my mother. So why did the knees receive me? And why did the breast of my mother feed me? Had she not nursed me, I would have died. Verse 13, for now I would have laid still and been quiet. I would have been asleep. Then I would have been at rest. The reason he preferred to die at birth is he would have been still, quiet, asleep, and rest. I wouldn't be in this torment had I just died when I was born. Seems like a good alternative to me. Verse 14, with kings and counselors of the earth who build ruins upon themselves. If he'd have died at birth, he would have been numbered among the kings and the wise of the world instead of being on an ash heap at the trash dump in such great pain. Verse 15, or the princes who had gold and filled the houses with silver. If he'd have died at birth, he might have been buried with the rich. Remember, he's one of the richest men in all the East at this point. The reference to silver has been taken by some to be a reference to the tomb. But again, the point is the same. He's saying in just a variety of different ways, I wish I had died at birth. So he asks a question, verse 16. Or why was I not hidden like a stillborn child, like infants who never saw light? This is the same question he asked at the beginning of this section, back in verse 11. Verse 17, the reason Job would have preferred to have died at birth is that in death, the wicked don't cause any trouble. So he says, there the wicked cease from troubling and there are weary are at rest. In other words, had I died at birth, then wicked people couldn't have tormented me. Just another argument for, I wish I'd have been born and died. Verse 18, there the prisoners rest together. They do not hear the voice of the oppressor. In death, even prisoners are at rest. They don't have to listen to their oppressors. And then he says in verse 19, the small and the great are there, and the servant is free from his master. In death, the small and the great and the slaves are free from their masters. So he says in verses 11 through 19, I wish I had died when I was born. One author says this picturesque language expresses the experience of rest, which a dead person seemingly has, in contrast to the restless condition of the living who suffer. All who suffer intensely as Job can appreciate his longing for a release through death. Now, Wish I'd never been born. Wish I'd never been conceived. Wish I'd have died when I was born. Well, none of that happened. So now what? Look at verse 20. He asks a question. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter of soul who long for death, but it does not come, and search for it more than hidden treasure, who rejoice exceedingly and glad when they find the grave? Now, what he's saying is this. He's now talking about the present instead of the past. Up until this point in the passage, he's saying, I wish I'd not been conceived, I wish I'd not been born, or I wish I'd have died when I was born. Now he's saying, all right, none of that happened. So in one long sentence from verse 20 through 22, he's saying, well, why can't I die now? Didn't happen then. I'll settle for now. So he asks why life is given to those who are miserable and bitter. Why life is given to those who suffer great pain. Why life is given to those who desire death. Those who search for it as if it were a hidden treasure. Why life is given to those who are glad when they die. Or to sum it all up, why are people who are in great pain given life when they prefer death? So he's again saying, I just want to die. Told you this was shocking. Verse 23, he asks another question. Why is light given to him whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? In other words, he asks why life is given to those whose way is hidden from them. He doesn't know where he's going. God's hedged him in. He's restricted him. His suffering has limited his freedom. So he says in verse 24, for my sighings come before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water. And all he's saying is that these mournings and groanings come before he can even eat, doesn't enjoy eating, and his groanings come out like water, probably a reference to just the flood of tears coming out of his eyes because of the pain. Two more verses. It says in verse 25, for the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. Now, this could be what he dreaded before he had these problems, or it could be what's happened to him during these problems. He's just saying, this is what I feared would happen, and I just want to die. So he concludes in verse 26, I'm not at ease, I'm not quiet, I have no rest, for trouble has come. In his pain, in his suffering, in his agony, he had no peace, no quietness, no rest. He only had suffering and affliction. And he's a deeply spiritual man. Remember that? I know a fella who said, Job was in despair, but not defiant toward God. He was feeling his pain intensely, but not accusing God of being unjust. The present agony became so overwhelming that sufferers can not see beyond it. My own father, who I know was a deeply spiritual man and an outstanding Christian leader, this friend of mine said, my own father suffered from bone cancer, and before he died, longed for death, even though he was a godly believer. The experience of great pain is the will of God for some people. We must not make the mistake of misjudging those who are going through this valley of the shadow of death. And as we shall see, that is precisely what Job's friends did. But that's for another day. What do we learn? What do we get out of all of that? Can I say it very simply? Job's friends came to comfort him. They had the right idea. They didn't stick with it, as we shall see, but they had the right idea. They were there. They came to comfort. They were silent and they listened. All right, flip the coin. What's the other side of the coin? When your family members come to see you when you're in pain, or your friends come to comfort you, what do you do? Here's the one simple, single lesson I want you to learn tonight. You ready? You tell them how you feel. May I repeat that? You tell them how you feel. If there is anything Job 3 teaches, it's that. He told them how he felt. And the way he felt is shocking to most people. I wish I'd never been born. I wish I'd have died when I was born. I wish I'd died now. I just prefer death over this miserable existence. As shocking and horrible as that is, that's what Job did, and that's not a bad idea. If you learn that one lesson, it'll serve you well. Now, having said that, I want to talk about that for a minute. I'm going to suggest that you don't have to do this. I think there are some psychologists who would say, you've got to do it or you'll stuff your emotions and it's unhealthy. Well, I agree that if you stuff your emotions, that's unhealthy. But the way they talk, you've got to talk about everything. That may be helpful to some people. I'm going to say that in a minute. But it's not a biblical requirement. There's nothing in the Bible that says you gotta. And I think I've known of people who didn't. They just talked to the Lord. Now, I'm not suggesting that you don't feel your feelings. I'm not suggesting that you don't talk about them. I am suggesting that it isn't imperative that you talk to another human being. But I also think that the person who does that is a rare individual. And they're usually male versus female. Women are more likely to talk than men. Men are more likely not to talk. Now, having said that, I want to say that it seems to me that it's a good idea to go talk to somebody. Would you like the biblical basis for that? I just read it to you. Job 3. Where else does that happen? The biggest book in the Bible is about people going through all kinds of traumatic situations and writing it down in poetry. You know what book that is? The Psalms. I once heard Billy Graham say that every emotion known to man is expressed in the Psalms. I think he said every emotion known to believers is expressed in the Psalms. Now, since then, I have been through the book of Psalms, analyzed every one of them, and I walked away thinking, you know what? He's right. It's hard to imagine an emotion, a feeling that isn't somewhere in the Psalms. So, whereas you don't have to, it's a rare person that doesn't need to. So, go find somebody, a friend, and just tell them what? What do you tell them? How you feel. That was kind of weak, but that's the idea. Now, having said that, let me say, don't tell everybody. Be selective. I remember once when we were meeting in the fireside room, somebody came in that hadn't been here very much and just spilled everything. And after it was all over, I don't know if she remembers or not, but Kathleen and I looked at each other and said, you know, sometimes that's not a good idea. Now, all I'm suggesting is if you just, and there are people like that, they just, go tell everybody. And you know, after a while you see them coming, you think, oh no, volume number 37, here it comes. Volume 1 times 37, that's right. And that's true. It's the same volume over and over like a broken record. So you don't go tell everybody. Be highly selective. Go find that trusted friend and pour out your soul. We got it? All right. I'm not done. If there's anything else this ought to teach us, is that highly spiritual people do this. Godly people go through this. If you've been with me from the beginning, a short time ago, we talked about the fact that the book opens with, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, who feared God and shunned evil. He was perfect. Can't get any better than that. That's the man that said, I wish I were dead. I wish I'd never been born. So, just know that deeply godly people go through this experience. Don't judge them. Somebody has said there's a point at which any man simply throws in the towel. He does not abandon his faith, necessarily. He just gets thoroughly sick and tired of trying to put on a good face for things when the things he is facing do not have any good about them at all. This is not sin. It's just plain honesty. He's calling a spade a spade. Job is a forthright and plain-spoken man. So, just know that the pain can be so intense that you just wish you had died. It's a biblical experience, folks. Now, I'd like to end by really underscoring that last point. Some of the most famous Christians in church history have had this experience. I'm going to tell you one story, and maybe later in the book I'll tell you some others. But I want to tell you the story of a man you may not have heard of. His name is David Brainerd. How many of you have heard of David Brainerd? All right. I have to tell you about David Brainerd. He was a missionary. But that's the story I want to tell you. So sit back and listen to this story. His life was filled with trials. He attended Yale University during the Great Awakening in the 18th century. In 1740, the faculty considered that Great Awakening a problem. They considered the spiritual enthusiasm of the students, prompted by visiting preachers such as George Whitefield and others, to be excessive. They didn't like all of that fanaticism that was going on in this revival. So in 1741, the trustees passed a resolution, a decree, quote, if any student of this college shall directly or indirectly say that the rector, either of the trustees or tutors, that's the professors, or hypocrites, carnal or unconverted men, he shall be for the first offense made a public confession in the hall, and for the second offense be expelled. By the way, you do understand that Yale University was created to train preachers. And that at this point in history, all the people in that university were professing Christians. But the people that were caught up in the revival looked at those people and said, well, some of these people aren't even saved. And so they passed a resolution and said, if you say that about us, you're going to be punished. I think that's a riot. On the afternoon of the day the trustees passed the resolution, Jonathan Edwards, who was a spark plug in this whole thing, and too, George Whitefield and Jonathan Edwards were the movers and shakers of the revival, spoke at commencement. The trustees thought that he would support their position. He sided with the students. During the next term, Brainerd was expelled because he said one of his teachers had no more grace than a chair and wondered why the rector did not drop dead from fining students perceived to be overzealous. Later, he apologized for the first comment and denied making the second. Brainerd's expulsion from Yale prevented him from entering the ministry, because the state of Connecticut forbade the appointment of ministers unless they had graduated from Harvard, Yale, or a European institution. All those institutions, by the way, were started to train preachers, including Harvard, Yale, and we'll get to some others in a minute. When a leading Presbyterian in New Jersey was unsuccessful in getting Brainerd reinstated at Yale, he became a missionary among the native Indians, that is, Brainerd did. He had a disease greatly considered to be, or generally considered to be, tuberculosis, and he suffered many hardships as a missionary, such as lack of food and loneliness. He died at age 27 in the home of Jonathan Edwards. Brainerd's life had an enormous impact that's probably contributed to the fact that Jonathan Edwards, who wrote a number of books, wrote the biography of David Brainerd. It was first published in 1749. Edwards wrote and edited a version of Brainerd's diary. It gained immediate recognition. John Wesley said, let every preacher be careful over his, read carefully the life of David Brainerd. It was the most reprinted of Edwards' books. It has never been out of print and has influenced subsequent generations mainly because of Brainerd's single-minded perseverance in the face of sufficient suffering. This man's life, he lived 29 years. This man's life was so focused on the Lord that there is no telling how many people have been impacted by the book just recording his life. Missionaries who have asserted the influence of Jonathan Edwards' biography on their lives include William Carey, Jim Elliot, and Adoniram Judson. And those are some of the famous missionaries in the history of the church, all influenced by the life of David Brainerd. Brainerd's life also played a role in the establishment of Princeton University and Dartmouth. The expulsion of Brainerd and Yale's refusal to readmit him were important factors in driving individuals such as Jonathan Dickerson and Aaron Burr to establish Princeton. In fact, classes began in Dickerson's home in May of 1747 while Brainerd was recovering there. In 1748, Dartmouth College originated from a school for Native Americans and Colonians, and it was founded by a man who was inspired by Brainerd's example of working with Native Americans and being concerned about their education. By the way, Yale University later named a building after him. There is a Brainerd Hall at Yale Divinity School, the only building on the campus to be named after a student who was expelled. Now, here is a man who had enormous suffering, maintained his godly character, and had an enormous influence on countless thousands and maybe millions of people, including some deeply significant influences in people who became outstanding missionaries. Well, let me tell you the rest of the story. In his final years, he also suffered from a form of depression that was sometimes debilitating, and on at least 22 occasions, He wished for death. Suffering. Saints can wish to die. Did you hear that? Saints can wish to die. And it is permissible to express those feelings. And our job is to listen. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this example of a man who had integrity and character, honesty, was willing to talk about his feelings to his closest friends. Lord, teach us to be in contact with the way we feel. Teach us to listen to those who are undergoing suffering. Help us to be good friends. Teach us to listen. In Jesus' name, amen.